This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 23. I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. The Tome is a D&D review podcast, and in this episode, we will be playing a cunning game with Dragon Magazine, number 358, and Dungeon Magazine, issue 149. Welcome again to episode 23 of The Tome, Dragon 358 and Dungeon 149. First of all, don't forget The Tome is having its first ever contest. Fabulous prizes could be yours, literally hundreds of dollars worth of prizes sitting in a box in my living room, ready to be shipped out to you. Here's how you enter. Create something for the show. A logo design, a banner, a promo, a guest review, recorded or written. Send in an audio comment, anything like that. Make something for the show, send it on in, and you're entered into the contest. Or you can also help promote the show. Play your promo on your podcast if you're a podcaster. Link to the show. Add a banner to your website, blog, MySpace, that kind of thing. Email me a link to the page and I'll verify that it's done. Each time you do one of those things, either create something for the show or help promote the show, your name will be entered into a drawing for one of three awesome prize packages. The sponsors include Swords Edge Publishing, a PDF, an online PDF publishing company, Geek Labeled, a fabulous geek apparel business that sells great quality shirts and other items on their website at geeklabel.com. Mayhem Comics, a wonderful brick and mortar comics, games, all kinds of stuff, geekly, I guess, distributor located in Iowa that has a fabulous subscription service that I've been using for 5, going on maybe 6 years coming up soon. So they're great. And our probably the biggest sponsor is Green Ronin Publishing, publisher of some great D20 products and some great independent products. So go check those guys out. Links are available at the website, and more information for the contest is also available at the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Get those submissions in really fast. As of this recording, there's like a week left for you to submit. So get that stuff done. In other news, I mentioned it in the last episode, I'm thinking about doing some format changes for the show. And I'm thinking to start those, or at least announce that, around episode 25. It seems like an appropriate time. So that's also coming up fairly quick. I'd really like your input as to what type of format change I should go for, whether it just be a little tweak in moving some segments around, or whether it should be a bigger overhaul. One of the options I'm considering is doing more shows but making them shorter, trying to get back down to that 20 to 30 minute guideline, but doing the shows more often and having each show be something a little bit different, like having two shows a month be reviews or interviews, having one show a month be just all about news, and having one show a month covering a new segment, maybe talking about advice and helping people and talking thematically about different things specifically to D&D. There's lots and lots of gaming podcasts out there that are awesome that do a lot of advice and thematic sort of shows, but none of them do it specifically about D&D, so I thought maybe we throw in one segment a month that sort of covers that. Again, I'd really like your input, though, to hear what you want to have done with this. So head on over to the forums. I've got a thread started. Just shoot me some information about what you want to see done. The forums can be reached, again, through the website at www.thetomeshow.com, and then just click the little icon that says forums. Since this is a magazine review episode, I'm going to not do D&D news specifically, because a lot of that news is going to be coming up through the magazines. Plus, I did a lot of news last time.
Hey, you. You listen to this podcast. Yeah, I got to talk to you for a second. I got this friend here. He's doing this podcast. It's a book, a podcast novel. And he's asking me, how do you think I can get the people to listen to this podcast. And I understand his problem. I mean, there are so many podcasts out there. It's tough to choose, huh? But you know what I told him? Respect. Respect is the best way to get people to listen. When the people respect you the way I do, it reflects on you and your family. So if the people respect you, then they will listen. That's what I told him. Now, this podcast is Bill Bob Battings and the Case of the Singing Sword, done by a friend of mine named T. Morris. And I respect him. I respect him like family. So I think the best thing for you to do is listen. Because if you don't listen, then, you know, you're being disrespectful. And if you're being disrespectful to his family, you're being disrespectful to my family. We understand each other? All right, that's good. Now, here's a pretty lady to give you all the details.
Billabub Battings and the Case of the Singing Sword. Find out more by clicking on the Billabub Battings podcast banner at www.tmorris.com.
Okay, you got all that? Capiche? That's good. Really good. So why are you still here? I mean, what are you doing? Shouldn't you be subscribing now?
Hi, this is Jon from Norway, one of many international listeners, and you are listening to The Tome.
Dragon Magazine, issue 358. There's only a couple of issues left of Dragon, and then we're going to have to start looking at some new things here on the show. I know William Paul, who is my dungeon reporter, or our dungeon reporter, the fabulous William Paul, who we're going to hear from later today, has been talking about maybe doing some Pathfinder coverage, which is Paizo's new product line to fill the gap of the large adventure paths that Dungeon was doing. And I know I've been kind of contemplating doing a quarterly review of Kobold Quarterly, the new online magazine being offered by Wolfgang Bauer, who I had the luck to speak to last week. I did a little interview with him, so you can expect to see that coming up in the next month or so. I've had got three interviews that I haven't released yet. I've got three or four reviews ready to go from other people that I haven't released yet. I've got one review that I've promised somebody that I would get out soon, so I'm hoping maybe to get that even out later this week. So there's a lot on the plate of The Tome right now. So keep your ears tuned. First, let's look at the First Watch section and the news in Dragon Magazine this month. First up, they talk about the expedition to the ruins of Greyhawk, the newest book in the line of expedition. They sort of explain a little bit how this gets you back in touch with what Greyhawk was when it was created. At the same time, it's not just a location book. It's not just about the ruins of Greyhawk. It's actually a full-scale adventure, and about a third of it, they say, actually takes place in the Free City of Greyhawk itself. This is brought to you by authors Jason Bowman, James Jacobs, and Eric Mona. Notice that these are people that are highly involved in Paizo. In fact, I just spoke to James Jacobs for another interview that you're going to be hearing in the next several weeks. I just spoke to him yesterday, and he says that this is a very cool-looking book. So I look forward to hearing people's thoughts on the expedition to Greyhawk. Also, of course, don't forget that coming up very soon is Gen Con Indy, the 40th anniversary. The guest of honor this year is going to be Gary Gygax himself, the co-creator of Dungeons & Dragons. They'll have all the fun things that you expect, the costume contest, the true dungeon, all kinds of games. There's a family pavilion. I know tons and tons and tons and tons of podcasters are going to be there. There's going to be a whole podcasting gathering for podcasters to get together with listeners and sort of sit back and chat and have a good time. There's a whole track of podcasting. I know a lot of people that are going to be there. My good friends over at our sister podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, are even going to help get me some interviews with some more designers and authors while they're over there. So that's going to be awesome. Unfortunately, I can't make it because, of course, I'm a teacher by trade, as I've sort of mentioned, and being a teacher by trade, I actually am going to be back in school when Gen Con is going on. So no luck for me. In other news, Paizo Publishing is also starting a new line of fiction and science fiction fantasy novels called Planet Stories, and the first one is being released. It's called The Anubis Murders, and it's by Gary Gygax himself. So that could be really cool. Also, White Wolf has announced the return of Changeling. There's the old Changeling RPG game out that's been around for a while, and as they've re-sort of set the World of Darkness setting, they're also resetting Changeling. This is the story that sort of covers the Fae or fairies and shapeshifters and that kind of stuff. Seven Swords of Sin is going to be coming out soon from Paizo Publishing. It's part of their Game Mastery line, and it is a new module fitting into that whole Game Mastery line. So that looks cool. Other news that looks interesting, there's more information about Pathfinder, but you're going to hear a lot more about that in a little while when you hear the interview from James Jacobs. There's an article talking about Assassin's Creed, a very cool looking video game for the Xbox 360. Now, I don't have a 360, and I've never really wanted to get a 360 until I saw some of the footage from this game. I don't have a lot of time to sit around and play video games. It just doesn't fit into my schedule very well. So that's why I don't have a 360 now. But man, Assassin's Creed looks cool. It's set during the Crusades in Jerusalem, and you play the role of an assassin in a very beautiful looking, three-dimensional, very cool looking setting that you can sort of interact with in a lot of neat ways. And so they've got a little article talking about this and the coolness of being the super cool, awesome assassin guy. Now we get into the articles. First is Dragonlance the Movie, Dragons of the Silver Screen by Mark L. Feigl. Art provided by Epic Level Entertainment and Paramount. Special thanks to DragonlanceMovie.com. And this is all about how, in case you haven't heard, there is an animated Dragonlance movie coming out very soon. And it's sort of been in the works for a long time. It started several years back, and Tracy Hickman has sort of been talking to people and dealing with agents and dealing with studios, and it's been set to go, and then it's been set back, and then it's been set up again and set back, and it's sort of gone back and forth. But this fall, we will see the release of Dragonlance Chronicles, Dragons of Autumn Twilight. So be ready for that. There's all kinds of neat information about sort of the background and how that came about to be, and there's images about showing you sort of what it's going to look like, and it looks like it should be a really cool movie, and I know I'm looking forward to it a lot. They do announce some of the cast. For example, Tanis Half-Elven will be played by Michael Rosenbaum, very well-known actor from Smallville. He plays Lex Luthor. Goldmoon will be Lucy Lawless, Xena herself. Raistlin will be played by Kiefer Sutherland, and that is an interesting choice. I look forward to seeing what that's going to be like. Karaman is played by Reno Romano, who is from the Batman animated series. Tika is going to be played by Michelle Trachtenberg of Buffy the Vampire fame. And of course, there's many, many others listed, and that's just a quick, brief summary of some of the people that are going to be on there. So if you're interested in finding out more, check out this article, or head over to dragonlance-movie.com. The next section is another one of the Core Beliefs articles, St. Cuthbert by Sean K. Reynolds, illustrated by Andrew Howe, cartography by Robert Lazzaretti, of course. And first of all, the artwork is really cool. I enjoy Andrew Howe's artwork usually, and this is a very fine example of his work. Sean K. Reynolds is a well-known, well-respected, and well-practiced author, so I trust his work pretty well. It does get a little long for a magazine article in the opening, but it's all really good. It talks about the role of a cleric of St. Cuthbert. Now, it's kind of interesting because the images they use and the way they describe St. Cuthbert's followers is actually a bit different than what I had envisioned in my head. So it's really cool to have this sort of fleshing that out for me. I don't have a lot of experience with Greyhawk, and the core beliefs in D&D were originally the Greyhawk deities. So I didn't have a lot of background with it until 3rd edition came out, and then it was just that little blurb that's in the player's handbook, right? So from that little blurb, I had a very different perspective of what St. Cuthbert was all about. Okay, now that the phone is done ringing, I don't know if you guys could hear that in the background. It then goes on and talks a little bit about all kinds of different things. There's lots of little sidebars, the basics, the holy texts. Talks about about Ayaz the Old, who's a demigod, an evil demigod in Greyhawk, and gives a little bit of information about him. Talks about relationships between St. Cuthbert and other religions, holidays, paladins, some myths, new spells, new magic items, some suggestions for prestige classes, customized summon lists, planner allies, all the kinds of stuff that we've come to know and love in the core belief sections, which are really cool. And if I played using the core deities more often, I think would be just absolutely essential to try to get all of those together, even in a collected format, would be really cool to do. The next article is called Master's Forge, Crafting Legends, by Rodney Thompson, illustrated by Thomas Giorello. And this is all about creating items with special qualities, but not necessarily magical qualities. It has additional cost to it, it makes it extra difficult to do, but you get special benefits. For example, you could add a blood groove to a weapon, to a sword specifically. It costs 100 more gold pieces to make. The craft DC is 5 higher beyond a normal masterwork. It has to be masterwork on top of that. But you get some benefit. The weapon is reduced in weight by 20% or half a pound, whichever is greater, and the hardness increases. So you get some benefit that way. It just makes it a bit of a lighter weapon. There's caster armor, deceptive armor, or deceptive weapons, folding metal as a thing to do that you can do to your metal to make it stronger. There's just a huge list of these different things, and it's a really cool idea. If you've got a crafter, a skilled person who's not necessarily a spellcaster, you know, your normal, everyday sort of blacksmith guy out there pounding away at the steel that really knows how to do things well, can create some really cool stuff without having to call on the local wizard. It's sort of the idea that there can be this legendary smithy out in the middle of the wilderness, up in the mountains, that people journey to in order to get these special things that nobody else can make because this guy is a master, and he doesn't have to be a wizard to be a really cool blacksmith. So that's really cool. The next one is called Checkmate, Chess Made Deadly, by Kevin Boss and Eric Jansing, illustrated by Eric DeChamps. And what this does is it gives you a new type of creature called the Chaturans. And basically, the Chaturans are chess pieces. I mean, it gives all kinds of normal ecology sort of information about them, right? Treasure, society, how to integrate them into your game, what you can, you know, what characters might know about them, the lore section, all that kind of stuff. But when it's all said and done, it's chess pieces. You have a statted out construct, extra planar construct for a pawn, for a knight, bishops, rooks, queens, kings. And so you can sort of do your own little D&D chess game using these monsters. Next up is the ecology of the Kaorti. and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right at all, but I'm going to say Kaorti, by James Jacobs, illustrated by Peter Bergting. And the Kaorti is this really far out sort of group of people that used to be human-ish. It's connected to this idea of the Far Realm. It comes off very Cthulhu-ish if you're into that sort of thing. The Far Realm being this very alien sort of place. And basically, they actually integrate some information from the Forgotten Realms, but they never actually call it the Forgotten Realms. And it's kind of neat because you don't actually have to know anything about the Forgotten Realms for this story to make sense. They just sort of mention that the first people to become the Kaorti were from Imeskar, which is an ancient, long-dead empire in the Forgotten Realms. So I found that really cool, a neat little Easter egg for those of us that are really into the realms, but at the same time, not something that's going to hold anybody back who doesn't know it. It gives some of the history of how these Imeskari went to the Far Realm and, oops, bumped into this Elder Evil, and just by being in the very presence of this Elder Evil, it changed the nature of who they were into these really odd-looking humanoid-ish people, right? They've got the long claws. They're all completely covered head to toe in this dark black-gray sort of slimy skin stuff, right? The trick with the Kaorti is that they're always trying to convert other parts of other worlds so that they can survive there, and they're trying to turn more people into Kaorti. They are actually harmed by being in the prime material plane, by being in a normal sort of world, unless they sort of coat the area in this mucus that they sort of exude, and then that sort of makes things safe for them. And there's a whole creature that they introduce here that is actually just the sort of this walking stomach with tubes coming out that splurts out this mucus and covers things that they sometimes take with them to create a base of operations, and then they sort of grow and they grow and they grow. It reminds me a little bit of the Zerg from StarCraft wanting to be on the creep and that there's advantages for him. It's sort of like that, only a little creepier and I'd say much darker. The next article is our Savage Tidings article, The River Styx, by F. Wesley Schneider and illustrated by Ben Wooten. First of all, don't forget, this ties into the Savage Tide adventure path from Dungeon Magazine. And let me tell you, this adventure, I'm playing in this adventure in a play-by-email game right now, and we're still back in the city where the whole thing starts. And I tell you, this adventure goes places that I never expected. When I first started playing this adventure and when I first started reading about this adventure, I'm like, oh, okay, it's kind of a King Kong-y sort of story, right? You've got a bunch of people in the city and they find out about something going on and they go to this Isle of Dread and they run into all these monsters in this big mysterious place in the middle and there's these natives that sort of live there and there's this giant wall. It comes off very King Kong. But it seems that as you get to the root behind what's causing all of the things on the Isle of Dread and in the world and all that kind of stuff, it turns into this planar adventure. And so this one is all about the River Styx and how basically detailing what the players might do as they travel down the River Styx through the different layers of the underworld, the different places they might end up, Pandemonium, the Abyss, all that kind of stuff, the kind of things they might encounter, the kind of allies they might find in the larger quest. It's not necessarily the kind of allies you might expect because the quest takes sort of a different turn, and I'm going to leave it at that because I don't want to ruin it for anybody who doesn't necessarily already know what's going on. The next article is Volo's Guide, War Upon the Sands. This is your Forgotten Realms article by Brian Cortijo, with special introduction by Ed Greenwood, illustrated by John Gravato, cartography by Rob Lazzaretti. And this article details a lot of what's been going on with Unther and Mulhorand. This is an area of the Forgotten Realms that has not, to my knowledge, been detailed in the Forgotten Realms since 3rd edition. They haven't put out a source book that covers this in detail. It's sort of talked about here and there, but it doesn't get a ton of depth. This article gives you that depth. It talks about some of the major players, like the Church of Tiamat, the clerics of Gilgim, the followers of Hor, some of the dead gods. It talks about the politics and the history and what's been going on in recent years there, and how that's affected the people. So this is a really cool article if you're looking to take your Forgotten Realms adventure into Mol Haran and Unther. These are the Mesopotamia Egyptian sort of based areas of the Forgotten Realms. Or if you want to do a whole campaign there, there's probably enough there that you could at least get started and flesh the rest of it out on your own. The next article is Dragon Marks. That's your Eberron article. Fragments of the Prophecy by Russell Brown. Introduction by Keith Baker. Illustrated by John Gravato. And this one is all about the dragon prophecy. And it details very specific locations and events that deal with the dragon prophecy. The dragon prophecy in Eberron, if you're not aware, is this large overarching prophecy that nobody can fully understand. Supposedly only the dragons can really get the whole picture. And parts of the prophecy show up in different places and different things. They'll just be random symbols that show up in the grain of a tree that's cut down. Or they say that the dragon marks that show up on the dragon marked houses in Eberron that give people certain powers is part of the prophecy. And so they give you some of these different locations and events and things that are part of the prophecy and the magical powers around that. For example, the tree that was cut down that has a mark in the grain of it. And they detailed that there's two sections with this mark in it, and one section has this power, and one section has this power, and here's where they are, and one of them is lost, and it gives some interesting information. There's the marks of the obsidian flow is the other one. It is another one that is in Mornland, and it's sort of this plateau that has these symbols that show up on it, but only if you're a certain kind of person do the symbols show up. And even then, it's the symbols are something different and say something different depending on who you are. There's different runes created by giant ants that they talk about. There's Lesh fire gems. So these gems that show up with these little marks and glyphs in them that have specific magical powers, but at the same time are connected to this larger prophecy. And the Solareed calling tree, which is this tree that the roots actually form certain symbols. There's been this whole monastery that comes up about it. And what it does is on occasion it brings people back from the dead, but it brings them back reincarnated as something else. So you've got and then they usually end up staying and dedicating their lives to joining the monastery and protecting the tree. So you have this odd situation where there's this community of gnomes that live in the area, but none of the members of the monastery are gnomes because they're all reincarnated. They all maybe once were gnomes, but then they died, they were reincarnated, and now they're, you know, a human or an elf or a hobgoblin or whatever. Very cool. Next up is Sage Advice by Andy Collins, illustrated by Andrew Howe. And this month, the Sage covers a variety of questions on topics, random or obscure, sort of hitting, it seems like sort of filling in a lot of the gaps and answering a lot of those questions that he never really got enough of to be a theme in the past. So he's going to sort of fill them in and take care of it now while the magazine is still going on in this format. Then we get into the Class Act section. First up is the Adventurer section, and it deals specifically with monks. It is by Jonathan Vespa, illustrated by Tyler Walpole. And it deals with, basically it gives you real-life monks, Buddhist, Franciscan, Knight Hospitaller, and Shinto monks, right? And it gives you specific ways to change your monk from the standard D&D to fit better into these types of monks and give you some information about sort of how, what they're all about. So it's a way to sort of make you, tie your monks to a more realistic sort of system and modify their abilities to sort of reflect that also. Next up is Arcane by Jonathan Drane, Tim Hitchcock, John E. Ling Jr., Hal McLean, and Troy E. Taylor, illustrated by Tyler Walpole. So you got a lot of people working on this, and it's called Arcane Feats. It's just different types of feats that your Arcane caster might take. Arcane Focus Item, Arcane Shorthand, Booksmart, Eldritch Claws, a meta magic feat called Forceful Spell, Grappling Blast, another meta magic called Slimy Spell, and Wedded to the Light. It seems like each of those people that worked on it maybe had to come up with one, maybe two feats to fill out this whole article. But if you're looking for more arcane feats, this might be a place to look. Then the Divine section by David Schwartz, illustrated again by Tyler Walpole, is the Aztec Mythos 4. And this is the fourth in a series of Aztec Mythos articles in the Divine section, detailing yet two more Aztecian gods, which once again I am not even going to attempt to pronounce. I detailed the first of these articles pretty strongly, and they've continued on with it, and the first one was really well written. Lots of good information. As a history guy myself, I found it very interesting. And so if you're looking for a way to integrate Aztec mythos or a Central American feel to your game, looking at these articles would be a really big help to bring that about. And so there's been four of them in Dragons 352, 354, 356, and now in this number 358. So every other dragon has had one of these for a while back now. Next up is Psionic by Mark A. Hart, once again illustrated by Tyler Walpole, and this article is all about psionic alchemy. Using alchemical substances to enhance or affect psionics specifically, which is not something that's been done a lot of, and so it's really cool to be able to do that. You've got the Aura Gel, you've got Cerebral Serum, Ectoplasmic Skin, Intuition Vapor, Mimic Clay, Liquid Stone, Psi Block, Psionic Ichor, Zeph's Blood, and Rejuvenation Essence. And these all tend to either enhance, detect, or inhibit psionic abilities. And it's all alchemical. And then we have Warrior. It's a Paladin Guide by Amber E. Scott, illustrated by Tyler Walpole again. And once again, Amber E. Scott brings us basically a two-page cheat sheet on how to play a certain class really, really well. This time, dealing with the Paladin. So if you've got someone new to the game, or if you're just not used to playing a Paladin, take a gander at this. Photocopy it front and back, take it to your game with you, and I think you'll be set and ready to go. And then we get into the comics. We've got The Continued Adventures of Nodwick by Aaron Williams, having a chit-chat with the mighty dragon Monty Cook, all one word, which is hilarious. You've got Dork Tower by John Kovalak, bringing you your normal panels of gaming hilarity. And you've got Order of the Stick by Rich Berlew, where it continues on from the previous article, the previous issue, I guess, comic, where the characters of the Order of the Stick bumped into a dragon, which is a thinly veiled allegory for the magazine, and the dragon started telling them some history about himself. And in this one, the dragon is talking all about how he was once created by this wizard who turned into a big red dragon, who then sold him off to this wizard who lives by the shore. And then that wizard got a new boss who is represented in the comic by Mr. Potato Head. And then the wizard created a new golem that would actually run, be in charge of him. And then the golem had to give him back to the wizard, and the wizard turned him into pure electricity. Hey. hilarious. I am obviously not doing it any justice. That's not my role in this case. But by far, this time around, I am giving Order of the Stick funniest comic of the issue, hands down, no doubt. This time warp through the history of Dragon Magazine is awesome. If only all history could be documented in such a hilarious way. Rich Berlew, I'm going to call you up and have you design comic strips to help me teach students from now on. Because that was cool. Well, that is Dragon Magazine number 358 for August 2007. I would definitely say this is more than worth the value. I would jump out and get this easily. If you're a Realms fan, this is awesome. If you're an Eberron fan, this has some incredible information. If you're looking for something more Greyhawk, you've got the Core Beliefs. If you're looking for something more Cthulhu-like, you've got the Katori. If you're looking for something more classical, I guess, you've got the chess pieces. I mean, there is something in this for everybody. Great issue. I look forward to seeing what they've got for us in the future, and at the same time, I'm still a little on edge trying to figure out what's going to happen next with the magazines. But in any case, next up, we have William Paul. Managed to get a recording in for us this time around. Thank you very much, William. He's going to be telling us about the latest Dungeon magazine, number 149. So I will just get out of your ears now and hand things over to William.
This is Ethan from the Gamers Haven podcast, and I'm speaking to you from the future. If you go to www.canadiancrusaders.com, starting on July 18th, you'll be able to witness the first annual Ennies Awards special. You'll also be able to enter into a contest to win one of three fabulous prize packages from GeekLabel.com and High Moon Media Publishing. It's amazing! You should definitely check it out. Now I gotta go before the time cops get me.
This is William Paul with a review of Dungeon 149, the August 2007 issue of Dungeon, hitting newsstands on the 11th of July 2007. As with any review of Dungeon, I'm starting in the back, then moving up to the front, starting with Dungeoncraft. This month, Handling Epic Good Guys by Wolfgang Bauer, illustrated by Kyle Hunter. Now, as we all know, any good or bad Dungeons & Dragons campaign has an epic bad guy, someone or thing that the players will have to defeat or overcome to accomplish their goals. Now, this article covers the other side of the alignment axis for those big important characters. Other than the player characters, you have the all-powerful Elminster, the Mordenkainen, anybody that your characters are going to meet up with that they don't have to defeat. This article provides excellent suggestions and ideas as to how to deal with those characters that are there to help the player characters. The article lists many different suggestions on how to handle them, how to use them. Sometimes it's just an employer. Sometimes as a merchant, if you will. The best suggestion I can see out of this article is a very good article. I've really enjoyed Mr. Bauer's Dungeoncraft ever since he took over the article from Montcook. The best suggestion I can see is these epic good guys that you have in your games, don't stat them out. There's usually never any need to do so. Now, moving on, we move into the campaign workbook. This month we have, as usual, two installments, The City and Wandering Monster. We have Cons and Swindles for The City. Now, this is provided by Russell Brown, again illustrated by Kyle Hunter. And This is just a small collection of random urban non-combat encounters. Basically, there's con men all over the world, in cities. Actually, this focuses on the con men that are going to run cons in cities that your player character is going to run across. And unfortunately, if the PCs aren't perceptive enough, they're going to fall for the cons. And this article just provides a few different suggestions, options that characters would be able to fall for. I'm sorry, this particular piece of the campaign workbook just didn't impress me much. I wasn't interested in having them and using them. I can see where some people might think, oh, this is a great idea, but it just didn't click with me. Then we have Wandering Monster in the campaign workbook, written by Kevin Bass and Eric Jensing, illustrated by Peter Berting. This is a article. For this Wandering Monster, we have a black willow. Think of a tree or treant and a black widow spider. Mix the two, and you have your monster for the month. This is a very interesting, very creative monster. I very much enjoyed using it in a campaign that I got to guest DM. Very deadly. And basically, its tree has branch attacks. It has a sleep attack. It has a consume feature where it actually swallows people up, swallows people whole, and lets them digest inside its trunk. And of course, I don't want to give you all the secrets if you're a player and going to run up against this. That just wouldn't be fun. But very interesting monster, very well written. And I can't wait to see more from these two authors, see what other creatures they can come up with. Next, we usually have the Map of Mystery by Christopher West. There is no Map of Mystery in this issue. Instead, we have a nice, clean reprint of the cover of the magazine. The demon, I believe the Witch Queen Igwivel, sitting in her den playing a game of chess. Very, very nice. And from what for those Map of Mystery fans that are unhappy about there not being one in this issue, the magazine does state that next month there is going to be a massive World of Mystery map, a poster map, so I, for one, definitely are looking forward to that. Now we move to the front of the magazine for the three modules, three adventures, low, mid-level, and high-level adventure. Next we have the War of the Wielded, intended for fifth-level players, fifth-level characters, written by Michael Cortez, illustrated by Udon, cartography by the Piazzo Met Monkey, Rob Lazzaretti. Setting is urban. It's actually set in the city of Sazerine from Dungeon 139, where the first third of the Savage Tide adventure path has taken place. The adventure is quite unusual, something I've never seen in any Dungeons & Dragons adventure before. There is essentially a group of intelligent weapons that the PCs run across, and the intelligent weapon essentially states, you know, you've got to help me defeat this evil group of people, this opposing guild. You find out that the weapon was created by a guild within the city that is unfortunately long since gone, but the weapon was developed, it was made to make sure that even if the guild was destroyed, their enemies would be destroyed as well. That their quest would live on beyond them not being successful. Now, as the adventure moves on, find out that the opposing guild, this evil guild that's been talked about by this first unintelligent weapon, is set up in the exact same way. Also intelligent weapons. And so the player characters are forced to consider, okay, what are our options here? Do we destroy all the intelligent weapons? Because if not, will they just continue killing people just to further their own needs? Or how do we handle this? Quite a good adventure. Next, we have Twisted Knight, intended for a group of 10th level characters, written by Stefan Hopp, illustrated by Andrew Hugh. Again, cartography by the map monkey, Rob Lazaretti. Setting is Temperate Wilderness, and it is set in the Forgotten Realms, listed as being on Korriban Island, part of the Corinne Archipelago, north of the Moonshae Islands. So if you're a Forgotten Realms fan, then this may be worth picking up this issue just for the actual Forgotten Realms adventure. Now, what the PCs are tasked with to do in this adventure is destroy a night twist that is set up on this island, Korriban Island, in order to save roughly 150 slaves. Basically, a night twist and a centaur have partnered up with some Muskins to offer up a group of people as slaves on the island, and the PCs arrive just in the middle of that exchange. The module does suggest that this adventure would definitely benefit if one of the player characters in the group has the feat Track. And overall, it is a very, very good adventure. This isn't the adventure that shines in the issue. The adventure that does is the 11th installment of the Savage Tide, Enemies of My Enemy, intended for 18th level characters, written by Wolfgang Bauer, illustrated by Ben Wooten, Warren Mahi, cartography by Rob Lazaretti. It has a planar setting down in the abyss, and this adventure alone would be worth the cover price of the magazine, just for what they include in the adventure. Basically, what the characters need to do at this point in the Savage Tide, they're in the abyss. They've just freed a demon from a prison to find out Demogorgon's secret, how to defeat him, and stop his Savage Tide from rolling over the entire world. Now that the PCs know how to defeat him, now they actually have to defeat him. And to do so, they can't do it alone. This adventure deals with having the PCs go across the outer planes and gather allies, gather troops for the assault on Demogorgon. This is one I can see this being a fun adventure to run, if you're running it as a part of the Savage Tide, or if you just take it out and run it as a part of another ongoing campaign where you have to make ties with planar allies. In this adventure, appearing with stat blocks are Charon, the ferryman of the River Styx, Igwilv, the Witch Queen of the Perrin Land, also the cover girl of the issue. You have to love the style that these people at Piazzo have with Dungeon Magazine. In the 5 years that they've been doing this magazine, I've never been disappointed with an issue. Yes, I've gotten more use out of some issues than others, but I've never been disappointed with an issue. We also have Orcus, the Prince of the Undead, Celeste. Anyone familiar with any of the Piazzo adventure paths thus far should have run into Celeste at one point or another. She appears in The Shackled City, she appears in The Age of Worms, and now she's appearing in The Savage Tide. We have the Eladrin in charge of the Whirling Fury. I'm sorry, I'm not going to attempt to butcher the name any further because I know I won't succeed. And Malkanthet, the Queen of the Succubi. I mean, just those stat blocks alone, I think, are worth the price of the issue. You never know when those people will be of value to a game that you're running, and to have stats for them available, if you're not just using them as plot devices, it would be very, very beneficial to have this issue. There is a new artifact listed in the article as well, in the adventure as well, the Iron Flask of Tourney the Merciless. And this is described as pretty much just like any other of the Iron Flasks in I believe it's the DMG, but it has some special tweaks to it that would benefit the PCs in this particular adventure, in the next adventure I believe also, and so it keep an eye out for that. There's also one thing I did notice about this adventure. If your group is one of those that would instantly recognize Celeste, if it's a group that has gone through the Shackled City Venture Path, Age of Worms, there wasn't anything that indicated it in the actual adventure. But one thing I would definitely do if I was a part of a group that had run the Shackled City adventure, and by the end of the Shackled City, you have a new Lord of Occipitus, another layer of the Abyss. Now, there's nothing in here that states that you can't go to Occipitus to set up the old player character from that prior campaign as an ally as well. I would think that if you've actually gone through both Shackled City and Savage Tide, that could be a real treat for players. And so if that is something that you have done, you know, really consider that. I would think that would just be, you know, put the players' experiences, their memories of the Savage Tide over the top. And so that is the review of Dungeon 149. Overall, I would say it is well worth the cover price. Taking in all the information, all the articles, aside from Enemy of My Enemies, I would say it's well worth the cover price. Enemy of My Enemies, that high-level adventure alone, also, just with that information alone, it's worth the cover price. I'm very sad that Piazzo's losing the rights to put out Dungeon. I am looking forward to Pathfinder. I know the Pathfinder will be just as good or better than what they've done with Dungeon, but this is definitely worth picking up. And that is my review of Dungeon. This is William Paul for The Tome.
Excellent job once again, William. I swear you are getting better at this every single time you do a review. I'm just afraid that pretty soon you're going to surpass me and I will become obsolete. But I'll tell you, if that day ever comes, it'll be a good day. Well, that's episode number 23, Dragon number 358, and Dungeon 149. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. One of the best ways is to participate, sending your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com, or let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show regularly. You can also instant message me, join the Tome Yahoo group, leave an audio, or call the Tome hotline at 206-666-2579. Although I haven't gotten many calls to the hotline, and I wonder if it's still active. In any case, you can also dig the show at dig.com, vote for us at Podcast Alley, or leave an iTunes review. All of these things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. Most of these can be found at the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Lastly, don't forget about this massive box full of books and freebies that I have ready to go for those people who win in the Tome Summer Contest 2007. Get those entries in now because there is very limited time left. The contest ends at the end of July, and then I will start announcing winners in episodes immediately following. In any case, this has been episode 23, Dragon 358, and Dungeon 149 of
The Tome.